This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cemeteries offer what we like to describe as a final resting place. The new book, Silent Cities, shows what the cities of the dead have to tell us about the cities of the living. My guests are the co-authors. Kenneth Jackson is the author of a previous book about the suburbanization of America. He's a professor of history and urban planning at Columbia University. Camilo Jose Vergara is a photographer who spent the past decade documenting urban devastation in America's slums. Jackson told me what interested him about cemeteries.
Well, first of all, Terry, I would say that it's quite simply the world can be divided into two sorts of people, those who like cemeteries and who are fascinated by them and who like to walk around on them, and those people who are delighted if they never set foot in another one.
See, I thought you were going to say it was divided between the living and the dead.
That's another cut. But there really are quite a large number of people who find cemeteries to be fascinating. I think partly because they really force us to come to terms with our own mortality. When we're in a cemetery, it puts your mind on a different level. And the other thing is there's so much to learn and enjoy in cemeteries. They're places of beauty often. They're places where there are thousands of stories that you can sort of piece together as you look at the grave markers. It's a special kind of a place, and I think many people enjoy it.
Camilo, as a photographer, what did you want to do in documenting cemeteries, and why did you want to document them?
Well, that was a very interesting question to me, because I started from a very different point of view. That is, cemeteries were places where I had to go around. They were right in the middle of the old cities, and they were long blocks with just one entrance, and sometimes there was no way out. And I have done 12 years, maybe longer, of photographing of urban poverty. So I spend a lot of time in cities like Newark and Chicago and throughout the New York City area. And inevitably, as I was going around some of the poorest parts of those cities, I would find a very beautiful cemetery. And the contrast could not be stronger. And then, of course, that attracted my interest. First of all, was the tremendous contrast between the affluence of the dead and the poverty of the living, which is was so obvious.
Can you say that the first cemetery in the modern style in the United States is in New Haven? It was established in 1796, the Grove Street Cemetery. What makes this, in your mind, the first modern cemetery?
Well, because attitudes toward the deaths, at least the removal of the remains of the dead, have changed quite a bit over the centuries, both in this country and around the world. Before Grove Street was established in New Haven in the last part of the 18th century, the typical burial spot was outside a church. Now, the idea being that, you know, closer to the church you could be, the closer to heaven or closer to God. The problem was that over time, the churches were often located in the middle of the urban community, because that's where their parishioners were, and space became more crowded. What Grove Street represented, and Grove Street itself is not, you only see the beginnings of the new form of elite cemetery there. It was a little bit removed from the bustling city. It was more spacious. It won't seem spacious to the visitor today, but it was more spacious at the time. And it began to reorient thinking toward the cemetery as a place that might be beautiful. And these kinds of places were so successful and so beautiful that they really represent the first public recreational open park space really in this country.
What do you think it says about our beliefs about death that we've tried to create cemeteries that were beautiful with lots of trees and grass, not to mention monuments, open space?
Well, what it says is, and it was seen at the time as such, it was a sort of a negation of the finality of death. And it was the belief that through nature and through the nature coming alive with every season, with the flowers blooming and everything, that the bodies and the souls would be resurrected and that the families would be reunited, so that the cemetery, with all the verdancy, was a reflection of a belief in immortality, that death was just sleep, that it wasn't going to be something that was going to last forever, And that most important, I think, that the family was going to be reunited. And that was a very important belief. And not just the family, but also the different groups. This happened later, you know, the engineers, the Salvation Army, the nuns of the Sacred Heart, the firemen, and so on. So that that the end was not really an end.
One of the things you both wanted to do in your new book is to get a sense of what the differences have been in ethnic approaches to burial, the differences between Italians and Jews, between blacks and Hispanics. I'm curious, Camilo, in photographing headstones and tombstones, what are some of the striking differences you found between ethnic and racial groups in America?
Well, I found that the ethnic the ethnic differences were very clear and very strong. So that you could, if you went to an Italian monument maker, or if you went to an Irish monument maker, or to an Irish section of a cemetery, you knew immediately because there were certain motifs that you would find over and over and over again. Same thing was true with German and Chinese and Japanese and so on. But I always had problems finding the difference between blacks and whites. I knew typically that if you went to a Newark cemetery and you look at people who had been buried there in the last 15 years, most likely those people would be black. Yet when I looked at their tombstones, I found that they were pretty much the same tombstones that whites of the same economic group would use.
There you see, Terry, so many of the important things. First of all, we see the class nature of American society. There are clear and very profound and striking differences within cemeteries between the mausoleums of the very, very rich, let's say, and the very simple graves of the very, very poor. So you see this. You see, as Camilo has expressed with his photographs in the picture, the differences between the various ethnic groups. That, you know, the Celtic crosses of the Irish look very different from the somber statues of the Germans, which look different from the uplifted figures of the Italian Americans. There are these differences that you can also see. The dissolution of the family in the last century, it's very common if you go to an older cemetery and, let's say, a grave marker, let's say in the early part of the 20th century, and you'll see one kind of tall shaft that will have the family name on it. And then you'll see all scattered around of it, maybe a half a dozen, sometimes as many as 70 family members with little markers around, which is telling you something about the centrality of the family. Now, if you go to a cemetery, you'll most likely see a husband and a wife. Some cemeteries, in fact, won't even sell you more than two plots side by side. And now, with the rising divorce rate, we're not even going to see these kind of markers, you know, forever together. So really, you're picking up so many aspects of American life just by looking at the cemetery within it. But to come back to this issue of racism or segregation, which I think we touched on, until very recently, especially in the South, but really throughout the country, blacks and whites spent no more time together in death than they did in life. In fact, there's a very famous marker in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, the grave marker of Thaddeus Stevens, who was a white congressman from Pennsylvania who was known for his leadership in radical Reconstruction after the Civil War. And he was buried in this old so-called Negro graveyard. And on Thaddeus Stevens' tomb, it says this, and he was white. It says, "I repose in this quiet and secluded spot, not from any natural preference for solitude, but finding other cemeteries limited as to race by charter rules. I have chosen that I might illustrate in my death the principles which I advocated through a long life, equality of man before his creator." But that was a very strong statement, just to be buried among black people, as if it made a huge difference. And I think that's part of this notion that we have, that the cemetery is such an accurate reflector of our society.
Well, while we're talking about how cemeteries reflect what happens in life in our society, I think it'd be interesting to look at Potter's Field in New York, which is a burial ground for the poor and for unclaimed bodies. You both went there, right?
Yes, yes.
And you need permission to go there. It's on a little island.
It was a very moving experience. It was early in the morning, and we waited in a sort of a by a shabby deck. We waited for the boat, but we didn't know that we were also waiting for the trucks that were going to bring the boxes, you know, the pine boxes where the bodies of grown-ups and children have been put, and sometimes limbs, you know, from a hospital or something. It just they are placed there and they are put in the big hole that has been dug at Potter's Field. So we took the boat, and that was almost a recreation of a sort of a mythical experience. You know, it was crossing expanse of water into the island of the dead. And you go to the island of the dead, and the island had been an old missile silo for the Nike missiles. And that's now abandoned. So there is this missiles that could cause tremendous death and destruction. We're sharing the island with the poorest of all New Yorkers.
There's about 750,000 people buried in Potter's Field in New York.
It's one of the most densely settled cemeteries because the land is reused over and over. As Camilo said, they had this big hole, and they buried people in mass graves of 148 people to a particular grave, all unmarked. And therefore, it really does have power. Although I think in some ways the sorrow and the tragedy of Potter's Fields is less profound to us in 1990 than it would have been to our fathers and grandfathers and grandmothers generations ago.
Yeah, because they saved so hard to have a plot in a good cemetery that they could get their whole family
into. Well, to them it was
into.
One of the worst things that you could imagine to be buried in a Potter's Field. Mm-hmm. That somehow they saved 10 cents a week, you know, in these immigrant communities or in these rural communities, so that when death came, that you could have a new dress and a nice coffin and be buried in a real grave and sort of go out in middle-class style at best. You know, now I think it's reflective of what we might call the death of the cemetery. I'm sure there are many people who wouldn't care whether they were buried in a Potter's Field or thrown out of an airplane or anything else. It seems it's somehow taken to be almost in irrelevance today, at least among many people, as to what happens to their bodies. And this kind of notion was almost inconceivable, I think, a century ago.
What are some of the other reasons you think that cemeteries are almost dying out themselves now?
Well, I think this is a real problem. It's hard to know all the reasons. I think just to draw the contrast, though, before we get into this discussion, I have a quotation from Judge Story in about 1831 when Mount Auburn Cemetery was dedicated. And his statement of what Mount Auburn was about then rings so strange in our own ears. Let me just read it to you. It says, "Dust as we are, the frail tenements which enclose our spirits but for a season are inexpressibly dear to us. We derive solace, nay pleasure, from the reflection that when the hour of separation comes, these earthly remains will still reclaim the tender regard of those whom we leave behind, that the spot where they shall lie will be remembered with a fond and soothing reverence, that our children will visit it in the midst of their sorrows, and our kindred in remote generations feel that a local inspiration hovers around it." They expected people to come visit their graves, and they thought that they would find inspiration there. We don't feel that very much anymore. We don't go to cemeteries. I gave a questionnaire out to class students of mine, both at UCLA and at Columbia University. And so many young people today have never even been to a cemetery, or maybe they've been once when their grandmother was buried. Very unlike the situation a generation or two or even 100 years ago, when visiting a cemetery was part of the ritual of growing up. You went to the cemetery on a regular basis, and that's where your parents took you. That was part of a weekend outing. We now, unlike the Chinese, for example, we have reverence for youth, and we have surgery, and we go on diets. We do everything to mask the fact that we're older. And then when the time of death does come, no longer do we sort of die in a sort of grandeur in our house at a deathbed and calling in our friends and family members to sort of give a last word and maybe hear a last piece of wisdom from this person who's now experienced life. Now we're not dead until we go into a hospital and get plugged into 14 kinds of machines, and it's done where no one can see it, and then someone just says that, well, they're gone now. So the experience of death has been removed from it. It's almost like this is too disgusting to talk about.
My guests are the co-authors of the new book, Silent Cities, The Evolution of the American Cemetery. Kenneth Jackson wrote the text. He's the author of a previous book on the suburbanization of America. Camilo Jose Vergara took the photos. He spent the past decade documenting American slums. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Kenneth Jackson and Camilo Vergara, co-authors of Silent Cities, The Evolution of the American Cemetery.
Camilo, earlier in our conversation, you were talking about how you had documented decaying urban areas, and you'd have to often walk through or walk around these really beautiful, wealthy cemeteries.
That's right.
Have you also documented decaying cemeteries that have been abandoned or have been allowed to go to seed?
Well, first of all, that's something that is much more common in England than it is in the United States. In the United States, there's still interest, and cemeteries, and by and large, still well cared, so that exceptionally you do see a cemetery, and that it's having problems. But oftentimes that has to do with this, with the place, the placement of a cemetery. For instance, it's deadly to have a cemetery next to a high school because that means that the high school students are going to be crossing through it or passing through it, and it's going to be incorporated into any prank or any free time that they have. I remember a cemetery in Queens where one typical thing that students would do would be to topple angels. They would actually throw a rope over an angel and then pull it, and the angel would come crashing down. And then there were a number of monuments that all the cemetery could do, because it didn't have the funds to fix them, was to pile them up. And as you look around, you saw these hills full of cemeteries with thousands of names, full of tombstones, I'm sorry. And those were quite striking. Now, cemeteries have ended in some other ways. You know, some of them have been on the paths of expressways. Some of them have been in place of facilities that have been built, so that, and some of them have been in place of urban development, so that they have been moved elsewhere. And those cemeteries are lost because all you can see there is what has been put there new.
Do you each own plots in cemeteries for your future?
No, I don't.
I do, but that's a fairly unusual circumstance. I think I'm one of the few people who does own a plot.
Kenneth, I'm wondering if you ever visit the graves of relatives.
Well, I do, Terry. It's because I had a 16-year-old son who was killed in an automobile crash 6 years ago, and that, of course, has changed my circumstance. Incidentally, I was already working on the cemetery project before my son's death.
Right.
But that does take me back to the cemetery. I do return to it, not with great frequency, but certainly at least every month or so. And I do find that when I go there, sometimes I do not want to go there because to go there is to know that you're going to become sad. I do think that that's one of the reasons we don't like to go to cemeteries, is because it really does make us come to grips with something that's very painful to us. And that's why I realize that sometimes when I'm driving, and when I drive into the cemetery, I turn off the radio, because somehow it seems that it's not right to be concerned with the latest news or the latest ball scores or something else if you're even approaching the grave of someone you love, which, by the way, is why I bought the plot, is when a tragedy like that happens, they'll only sell two at a time. So if you lose a child, you want very much to be buried beside that child. And otherwise, I'm sure I would not have prepared for that either. So that's why I'm a serious cemetery grave lot owner.
You could tell me if this is too personal, but when you visit your son's grave, do you feel like it's something you're doing more for you or more for him?
That's a tough one. I suppose maybe if I were to be honest with myself, it's more for him. I sort of feel like it's a way of telling him he's not forgotten. And the parent, I think, naturally feels, you know, you feel guilty if you survive your children. And that the very fact of survival, it's almost like being a Holocaust survivor. You know, it shouldn't have happened to you somehow. And you sort of want to go back, I guess for both of you. I don't know that I could separate those two out. But you sort of do feel, at least I feel, that I have to go back once in a while, even though every time I go, it hurts me.
Yeah. Well, let me say I'm sorry to hear about your son.
Yeah. If I could add something to that.
Yeah.
It just sounded very... it seemed to me that in the cemetery, in the first period, and I mean, let's say if 1940 or 1950 was a big watershed when attitudes changed, before that period, that kind of separation and the question that you just asked, Ken, it seemed to me would have been less on our minds than today. That was the great strength of the cemetery, was the fact that you could merge, is that your son was part of you. So you were your son and your son was you. So were your parents. And that the cemetery and to be with them, with all your ancestors in one place, or even within one cemetery, within different plots, offer you a possibility to place yourself in the past and to place yourself in the future. It offered you, it sounds like an amazing thing, but it did give you broad horizons.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure, Terry.
My guests have been Kenneth Jackson and Camilo Jose Vergara. Their book about American cemeteries is called Silent Cities. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.